Hi, you're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and we're ready to go live to to Ernest J. Gaines, who's being interviewed by Patricia Welch.
Welcome to KBOO FM Radio. I'm Patricia Welch, a co-host of the program Black Book Talk and the librarian manager at the North Portland Branch Library. Thank you for joining us for this very special Everybody Reads interview. Organized by Multnomah County Library and the Library Foundation, Everybody Reads is a community reading project that has involved thousands in the Portland area since it began in January. We've all been reading and discussing one great book, Ernest J. Gaines' A Lesson Before Dying. This classic book was chosen because it brings people of all ages together on common ground. As someone who works at Multnomah County Library, I can tell you that the public's response to this project has been tremendous. This is truly a town of book lovers. With the support of the Library Foundation, the library provided 3,600 copies of A Lesson Before Dying, and though that's more than Chicago used for a similar project, all our books were checked out by early January. Teens, families, adults, everybody has been coming to book groups, performances, film screenings, community forums to talk about this thought-provoking and terrific book. We are grateful for the support of presenting sponsor Fred Meyer and many other community partners who've helped make Everybody Reads such a success. This week, Everybody Reads culminates in a visit by Ernest Mr. Gaines, to Portland. Mr. Gaines speaks tonight at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $15 and $40 and will be available at the door. And now I have the great honor of interviewing Ernest J. Gaines on KBOO, Portland's community radio station. We're joined today by a studio audience who will be submitting questions for Mr. Gaines, and I'll read them in the second part of the show. Ernest J. Gaines, welcome to Portland.
Thank you, ma'am.
Let's see. Though this is Portland's first Everybody Reads program, it's not your first one. Your book has been chosen as the book that everyone in town will be reading in a number of cities. Can you tell us what that was like the first time for an author to know that a whole community was reading your book, that it was that well thought of, and what it's like now after you've done this many times?
Well, you know, a writer never knows what's going to happen to his book. Once he writes a book, he hopes that the book is published. And after it's published, he hopes that it's reviewed. And then after that's reviewed, he hopes that the public buys the book. But with a lesson, so many things happen. For example, Oprah picked up the book after it had been out there about 3 or 4 years. And then Seattle started the One City, One Read discussion of a book. I don't think any other writer have had this experience in the history of our country, that where cities all over the country are picking up that one book and having all the people to come and read it, regardless of who they are, book clubs or made up of black or white or Asian or whatever, and youth and aged and church members, and all these groups are reading that book. So it's just a fantastic thing to happen to any writer. I'm lucky. I'm one of the ones my book was chosen. I've been asked why, and I keep asking myself why as well.
Do you take it for granted now?
That
you will be chosen, that maybe once a year some city will call you out and say, we are doing your book.
Oh, no. I just hope, someone asked me that last night, and I said, I hope there are about 50,000 writers out there, and I hope that you will ask that person next time to discuss a book of his.
Okay, and I do want to mention that we all have lots of questions, but some of my questions are coming from Jefferson High School. Jennifer Duncan's 10th grade class visited us and picked up their books and said that they would share some of their questions. So if I ask you a question that comes from that class, I want to let you know that. And as a matter of fact, the second one, well, first I'll just say, tell us a little bit about Lesson for the 15 people in town who might not be familiar with the plot. Would you give us a little synopsis and then just tell us what inspired you to write the book, because that's what Theo from Jefferson High School wants to know.
What is the first part
of the
question?
First part is just a brief synopsis of the plot, in case there's somebody out there that doesn't.
Well, it's about a young man who's been sentenced to, who was in with two other guys who robbed, not robbed a store, but went to a liquor store, and the owner of the store is killed, and two of those young men are killed. And this one young man, Jefferson, had nothing to do with it, but he was with there at the time. And he's arrested, tried. At his trial, he's compared to an animal, to a hog, by the his defense attorney, to those people, to this jury, to show them what kind of person he was. He did not have the, according to this guy, the attorney, this Jefferson does not have the intelligence to have committed this crime. And he compares him to an animal. But still he was he's arrested and he's put into prison and he's been sentenced to be executed because the jury, this is back in the 40s in the South, in Louisiana, the jury just, a white man was killed. So this jury made up 12 white men because at that time in the South, only white men served on juries, sentenced him to die. His Jefferson's godmother, whom we call Nanan in Louisiana, approaches the young school teacher on the campus, on the plantation, and she wants him to visit Jefferson in the jail because now Jefferson has begun to act like the animal that is so described. So she wishes that this young teacher, visit him and some way make him realize that he's not an animal, but that he's a man before he dies. She knows he's going to die, but she wishes that he dies as a man and not as the animal as he was described in the courtroom. So this is something about the synopsis of the plot.
Okay, and several young readers wanted to know why you chose to write this book. What inspired you? Was it something in your life? Is it based on, things that happened in your life?
I had, I spent most of my life in San Francisco. I just crossed the bay from San Quentin and Marin County. And during that time, whenever there was an execution, it would take place on a Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock. And I often wondered how it must feel for someone to know that he's going to die at a certain date, at a certain hour. He would know this for several months before it happens, or several weeks before it happens. So how does he feel? And I was having nightmares about that because I could feel myself or a family member or friend being executed. And this went on over and over. And I thought that the way to exercise that was to write about it. So that was as one of the reasons why that I decided to write about it.
When you write books, are you writing just for yourself to get something out on paper that you need to deal with, or are you also writing with the hope that your books will change somebody's mind, change somebody's life?
Well, I write because I have to write, just as a baseball player must play baseball, or a fighter must fight, or a football player plays football. And I don't write only just for myself, and neither do I have a face in front of me, a group that I'm writing for. I write because I have to write. I cannot think of anything else to do with my life. I really write, I wish I could be, first I'd like to entertain you, the reader. By entertaining you, you would find some interest in that, in the life of those characters. The way that the book is written, the style it's written, is the characters believable? Is the dialogue believable? Is the narrative believable? The locale or place? Can you see that place? Do you believe in those people? This is what I want to do first. That's what I mean by entertaining you. Then I would like for you, of course, to get something out of it. But I don't believe in preaching. I don't preach.
Okay.
And as Mark Twain said, neither preach nor teach, but, I mean, that should not be the object of writing a novel, but the end result should do both. The book, you should get something out of the book.
Yes.
Oh, it's not worthwhile writing.
You're right, because this book was set in the 40s, and yet the issues that are involved in this are very topical today. I mean, the whole issue of the death penalty, the whole issue of what it means to be a man,
right,
the
yes.
whole issue of personal responsibility, these are all issues that are current no matter when you're reading.
Right.
What's the process for writing? For you? Do you, some people get up at 6 o'clock every morning, some people wait till inspiration comes, some people say, I'm gonna write X amount of paragraphs every day. What's your process?
Well, there's no such thing as inspiration. As Faulkner once said, writing is 99% perspiration and 1% inspiration. I don't wait for inspiration. I get up to write. I like getting to my desk by 9 o'clock when I'm writing. Okay. Getting to the desk by 9, and going for about 5 hours, 6 hours, whatever. I still write longhand. My first draft is always longhand. I go through a chapter longhand, and then I type it very fast, and then I go over it again, and I consider that one draft. I have to write on paper, there's canary color in here with my longhand. I can't stare at white paper for hours after a while, so I need this sort of yellowish paper.
Okay.
And then I write there. My first draft of typing it is usually on the yellow paper, and then I final draft is on the white paper, which I send to my my agent and my publisher in New York.
Okay. When did you become a writer? I mean, there are lots of people who like to write, and they know that in addition to their day job or whatever, they will write. But when did you make that transition and see yourself as a writer and feel like, I made it. I am a writer.
Well,
I don't know that I can.
I really don't know that I've made it yet. I'm still, every book is a challenge. Every story is a challenge.
Okay.
But I decided to become a writer when I was about 16 years old. And I decided to write it. And I wrote something which I thought was a novel, but no one else thought it was a novel. So I sent it to New York, and of course they sent it back, and I burned it in an incinerator in our backyard there in Vallejo, California. But I wanted to be a writer from the time I was 16 years old.
Did you know other writers? Was there somebody that was a role model for you?
No, I didn't know any writer. I visited the library in Vallejo, California, a public library for the first time, because I was not allowed to in the library in Louisiana, from my part of Louisiana. And I saw those books there, and but this is back in 49, and there were no books there in that library by black or about black in that library in 49. And but I was terribly lonely. And I did a lot of reading. I just read and read and read. And I thought I would try to write. I thought writing on books should not be too difficult, because look at the books in that library. There are many, many thousands of books there. So I tried to write a book. And of course, I failed in the beginning. And then I went into the Army. Spent 2 years in the Army. When I came back out of the Army, I enrolled at San Francisco State University. It was San Francisco State College at that time. And there I went into took up creative writing and in American literature. And I had a very good teacher. Well, I had very good teachers mm-hmm. at San Francisco State, and who encouraged me to write. As a matter of fact, a teacher whose class I went into in 1955 was at my birthday party last Saturday.
Wow.
So we've stayed in contact since 1955.
Okay. And a belated happy birthday to you. I learned earlier today that your birthday is on January 15th,
yes,
but you decided to come out and celebrate with your family out here.
Right. So. We celebrated in San Francisco last Saturday, yes.
What did your family feel about you being a writer?
They don't look at me as a writer. I think just my mother look at me as, they call me EJ or Ernie, and my brother and sisters feel the same way, I think. We're just brothers and sisters when I'm together.
I guess what I'm thinking of is, you know, a lot of us are told that you go out, you get an education, and you get a 9-to-5 benefits included job. Mm-hmm. When you were coming up, you just said that you didn't see that many African-American writers' books on the shelves. So I'm just wondering, did your family think, where did this come from? Were they always supportive? Did they say, well, honey, get yourself a job at the post office and do this on the side?
Right, they didn't encourage me or try to discourage me. It was entirely up to me, since I didn't have to, as long as I could support myself.
Okay, no, they weren't going to do that day job.
Now, if you want to write, okay, you go out and get yourself a part-time job and support yourself. You don't have to support your brothers and sisters or your mother, just yourself. And I can assure you that there were some many, many hard, hard, tough years between graduating in 57 and starting to be recognized in 67, but I gave myself 10 years to prove whether or not I could write or not. I said, okay, in 10 years, I must prove it or find something else to do, but I never knew what I would do.
And that was one of the questions that one of the youngsters was asking. If you weren't a writer, what could you be? You can't imagine anything
I have
else.
No idea. Maybe a school teacher or maybe, I have no idea.
Well, if you decide on a change, you know, it's never too late to be a librarian, but we'll just move on.
I spent a lot of time working in libraries. When I came out of the Army, I got a part-time job in a library at San Francisco State, and I also was a commissioner, a library commissioner in San Francisco, the city of San Francisco, and around a commissioner for the state of California. So I've been connected to libraries all of my entire life.
And we are glad. Mm-hmm. Another one of our young questioners wanted to know, do you have to start when you're young in order to be a great writer, or can you start later in life after you've done other things?
I wish, as I said, I went into that library for the first time when I was 16 years old, because I'd never been in a library before. I wish I'd had books when I was 6 years old. I would have had so much I had to make up in 16 that I'd miss when I was 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I don't know if reading books at 6 will make you a writer or whether reading books at 30 will make you a writer. I think it's something that you're born with, and if you're lucky, you find ways to enhance this desire, and you, as lucky as I was, although I started late, I had wonderful people to encourage me to be that writer. Quite a few people have started late. I attended Stanford University for 1 year, and I taught at Stanford for 2 quarters, and I had someone in my class who was about 80 years old. And she was going well, you know. And she started late, but she was writing.
Yeah. Hey, you said that you gave yourself 10 years to be a writer. Did you mean that if you were a successful self-sustaining person, that if you could make a living off of it, that made you a writer? What if you're a writer who is not picked up by a publisher, but who still loves to write, creates things that you respect and appreciate even if others don't? Are you any less the writer because you don't have a contract?
Well, I don't know how. I think a lot of writers are, people who would like to write are destroyed because they cannot, because they're not recognized. A lot of people are destroyed because they're not recognized at all, but many people are destroyed because they're recognized too early. You know, you write one book in your 20s, and all of a sudden they make you rich. You know, Hollywood makes you rich, and then you do other things then. You know, you become something else.
A celebrity. You become a professional celebrity.
Right, right. Yeah, and you don't write anymore.
Right.
So, I don't know.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about your upbringing. You know, I can't imagine a time when I couldn't go into the library. And I would imagine that's true for a lot of people who are here, but what was your upbringing like? Tell us a little bit about that, because it certainly comes through in ways in your writing.
I'm sorry.
Tell us about your upbringing.
Yes.
Before L.A.?
Well, I was born on a plantation, which is primarily sugarcane now. At the time when I was a kid growing up, it was cotton and sugarcane. I went into the fields when I was about 8 years old. I was, picking cotton and Irish potatoes and things like this. And I went to a country school. I went to a church. I didn't have a school. I had a church. We had less than 6 months of education a year. We had one teacher. We worked. We went to school when there was no work for us to do in the fields. That's when we went to school. That was pretty much and I had 6 years of education like that, if you call it education. Then I went to a small Catholic school for 3 years before going to California.
Okay. Tell us about your family.
Well, my my mother and stepfather went to California in 1948, for jobs, mm-hmm. and left me with my aunt who was crippled. My aunt never walked in a day in her life. Still, she raised me and my siblings. I'm the oldest. There were 12 of us. But at that time, there were only about, six of us. And my aunt used to crawl over the floor. She crawled over the floor all her life. She lived to be in her mid-50s. She could cook the food for us, our food, but we had to bring everything to the stove, to the wood-burning stove, where she would mix the food and cook it there. She washed our clothes. We had to bring the water, the tub, the old washboard, those metal washboards, and the soap and stuff like that. She sat on a little bench and she could brace her hands against the rim of the tub and just wash his clothes. She also disciplined us when we were bad, when we did something wrong. But we had to break our own switch. She sent us out into the yard to get the right length switch size, and she couldn't chase us, so we had to get on our knees and take our punishment. She also liked putting her hand into the earth. We had a vegetable garden beside the house. All of those places on this homes on this plantation had a vegetable garden either beside the house or behind the house. Ours was beside the house. And when it would get cool in the afternoons, my aunt would crawl over the floor, down the steps, and go into the a vegetable garden with a little short handle hoe and work among her different vegetables, whatever, beans and peas or okras or tomatoes or whatever she had in the garden at the time of year. We had pecan trees in our backyard, and she would crawl over the yard with a little sack and gather pecans and crawl back into the place and cook them, make pralines, or pecan cookies.
Oh, excuse me for just a second. Does everybody here know what pralines are? Okay, good. Then we can all do a collective. Okay.
She would do that, And all of this time, during those 15 years that I lived with my aunt, I never heard her complain once about her condition, summer or winter, when she crawled over that floor. I've been asked many times by, especially young kids, why do I put my characters, put such obstacles before my characters? For example, Jefferson has to grow up out of this feeling of non-human to a stature that he grows up to just before his death. Other characters of mine have had to face these same obstacles.
Yes.
And I feel that because of her, and she never complained about anything, and she had the greatest obstacle of anyone I knew, and yet she never complained. I'm sure she must have cried at time, and you know, but she would never ever let me see it. I was the oldest of my siblings, and I was responsible from a very early age to be, you know, to look after them, take charge. So that is my aunt who raised me, and I'm sure she's the greatest influence in my life, both as a man as well as an artist. Although I've learned from many people, learned from the old people, and learned from books, and learned from music and art and nature, but I think she had the greatest influence on me.
And was she the inspiration for Miss Jane Pittman?
Or? Only through her courage and the soul, but she could not do it, Miss Jane. Miss Jane tried to walk to Ohio at one time, so my aunt could not do that. And Miss Jane was constantly moving. My aunt could not move anywhere.
Okay. Earlier, we were talking just off mic about home training and what could be regional or cultural differences, but that there are certain things that were expected when I was growing up, and I think are still expected in certain parts of the country in terms of how children conduct each other, how children relate to adults, and also ideas about, you know, just what is appropriate and what is not. And as I listen to you talk about, you know, your aunt, and I think about young people now who think that if they don't have the right tennis shoes, they cannot leave the house, life is over. I know that you talk to a lot of young people. What do you tell them? What kind of things do you share with them? Because obviously, because you had such a wonderful example, now I understand why being an author wasn't a big deal to you. Sure, if you wanted to do it, you just got out there and did it. But what do you say to young people nowadays when you talk to them if they appear to be hopeless and think that life is just too difficult?
Well, I tell them about my own life and talk about the life of my aunt. And why I write about the characters that I write about.
Okay.
So I hope they get something out of that.
Right. Do you have any favorite characters?
Oh, no. They're all my children.
They're all your
my
children.
Books are, and I hope they're different, you know, in character. But I don't have any, I don't have any favorite, no.
You have any characters you dislike? I have
No. I am the creator.
Just
as God created all of us and some of us have, you know, have been bastards and others have been of good, but I don't think he dislikes us. He is a hot place for us, you know, for those whom he continually to disobey, but he still loves them at the same time. I love all my characters. I created them. I have to love them.
Okay. one of your young readers said, in your book, you emphasize how hard it is for a black man to live in the South. Did you as an individual encounter some of the same racist attitudes from the white people you encountered when you were growing up in the South?
Of course, yes. I lived in the South until 1948. And of course, there was, you know, complete segregation at that time. So in this little town that I called Bayonne in my books, there was no place uptown in that little town where I could get a drink of water or eat a sandwich or anything like that. Dentist's office or doctor's office were completely segregated, you in one area and someone else in the other area. If you wanted anything to eat or to drink, you had to go back of town, across the railroad tracks in the back of town. I suffered all the racism that we all did in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s.
Okay.
Yes, I went through all of that, yes.
And yet you have chosen now to live in Louisiana, and you could certainly live anywhere you wanted, not just in this country, but in this world.
Right.
Why did you choose to do that? Has it changed
well,
that much?
Well, I could not write about anything but Louisiana. We've lived in, my folks have lived in the same parish in South Louisiana since the time of slavery. I could only write about that part of Louisiana. I could only write about those people. Although I spent about over half of my life in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, the body was there, but the soul and the spirit and the love and the feelings were still back there when my aunt was buried and my people long before they lived, died, and were buried there. So I had a strong, strong connection to the earth and to the people there. I was invited to come back to Louisiana by the University of Louisiana Lafayette back in 1981. And they made me an offer that I couldn't refuse. They said, okay, you teach what you want to teach, you teach when you want to teach it, and here's a house to live in. And so I thought, okay, I'll teach one half the semester, half the year, and the other half of the year I spent in San Francisco writing. So that's how I started coming back to Louisiana. Lately, we have my wife and I have bought some of that land on that same plantation where my folks had once been slaves. So that's why we're still there.
Okay, and that comes out, that love of the land, that connection to the land comes out in a lot of your books. As I had mentioned to you, I am listening to A Gathering of Old Men, and when one of the characters is looking out, and actually what he's envisioning is what's not there, and he talks about the flowers that aren't there, and it's that wonderful call and response.
Yeah, right, yes.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it's that those things are not there anymore.
Right.
Only the memory, but... Right. The fields have taken over the place where my folks live, once lived. It's not there anymore.
Right. But that just came through so strongly, and it was a beautiful connection. And I would say to any of you, if you have not, well, from my perspective, if you could read one other book, I would say A Gathering of Old Men. If you could, if you told people, if you could read, and I know they're your children and you love them, but if there was just one other book and you had to make this decision, what would be the other book that you would tell people, or the book that you would tell people to read next? Because they're going to read all of them, but what would be the book that you would tell people to read next after a lesson?
Oh, I don't know. I made Miss Jane Pittman or Gathering of Old Men. Then the Bloodline stories. I don't know which book I'll tell them. But okay. I think I might lean toward Miss Jane Pittman.
Okay. I think I asked you earlier, do feminists just write you love letters? Because you write some of the best, strongest women characters.
And I think I got that from those strong women characters from being around my aunt so much.
Okay. I think we're about midway through, and we want to open it up a little bit. Is there anyone out there? I see a gentleman now.
Recognize the person, the question, and then the person who asked the question might ask him to.
Okay, let's see. The question is, what did the library seem like to you when you first went to Vallejo, and who raised that question?
Hi. And what is the question?
Why don't you come here? I'm happy to share my mic.
Okay. Oh, well, the radio audience heard that, I'm sure. As a librarian, which is my background, I'm really curious, what did the library feel like or seem like to you when you went in for the first time at age 15?
Great. I remember the first day I came into the library, I remember walking up the marble steps to the foyer, and there are these people, they're reading, sitting at a table reading. And there were different people, different ages of different races, and they're sitting around these tables reading. And I just sat at a table and took a magazine at random and spent most of my time looking around than I did reading. Then I noticed some steps going to another floor. And it was there where all the fiction was and poetry and philosophy. It took me a long time to get up there because I was not used to just going anywhere I wanted to go. I was never felt free enough to move about. So finally I made up my mind to go up there, and it was there that I discovered all those books, and there where I started reading and reading and just spending all my time reading books there. It was a strange experience to go there for the first time. But as I said, I've been connected to libraries ever since then.
Okay. If you only had 6 inches of space on a bookshelf, which books would you devote to those 6 inches?
6 inches of books?
6 inches. Could we make it maybe a yard?
Okay.
6 inches is pretty. Oh, he's saying 6 inches.
6 inches of books, because I have about 350 linear for the books. I think I would take a good, I think I'd get the Bible there. I'd put a good encyclopedia there. Maybe a dictionary. I think that's what I would get. If you ask me the same question tomorrow, I'd change it. I'd sit, put all of my books up there. And okay. 6 inches, put my books there.
In the book, Jefferson was executed for a crime he didn't commit. What are your thoughts on capital punishment with its possibility of executing an innocent person? Okay. Essentially, the writer wants to know, what are your thoughts on capital punishment with its possibility of executing an innocent person?
Well, I'm against capital punishment, definitely against it. And it just worse when it's administered to an innocent person. But I'm even a guilty person, I'm against it.
Let's see about Grant. As a narrator, oh, I'm sorry. Did you want to say
that? No.
Okay. As a narrator, Grant Wiggins seems emotionally distant. How did this aspect of the narrative seem important or necessary to the telling of this story?
Well, Grant is also one of the main characters of the story, and I didn't want someone to be so emotional that he couldn't be objective. I prefer dealing with someone who rather cynical than to have someone who's so maudlin that I just cannot get through his care for his narrative. I think Grant was ideal for tell the story because I wanted a contrast between Grant and Jefferson and Grant and the minister. The minister never could have told this story. And I could have done it objectively, but from the omniscient point of view. But I chose to tell it from a first person because I write better from the first person point of view than I do from the omniscient point of view.
Okay, this is a rather lengthy question, so I hope I do it justice. I used to work in hospice, and many of the themes that the character Jefferson addresses are similar to what many in hospice face: questioning the reality or presence of God, reflecting on their own worthiness, and reviewing their life situation and thinking, what if this situation was different? Have you ever been faced with or helped someone as they lived to die before you wrote that book? Okay, let's see something. Or help someone as they, they lived till they died. So essentially, did you ever help someone at the end of life, someone who knew they were going to die as they were facing their mortality before you wrote A Lesson Before Dying?
No. No, I created all of that. I've never, a minute point now. I teach creative writing, and I teach at night, and I'm constantly getting lawyers in my class, and I had an attorney in my class back in the mid '80s who had a young man on death row, and I could always tell when he had met this young man, seen this young man. because I could see this drain waste look when he'd come into the classroom. And just before the young man was to be executed, my student asked me if I would like to go to Angola to visit him. And I said, no, I can't, because I didn't want to look in this guy's face, he knowing that he's going to die within a month at a date, I mean the day, the hour. And I knowing, I'm aware of it. So I said no. And I think that's one of the reasons why Grant is not at Jefferson's execution. Because I could not face it in reality. Grant does not face it in the books either. I've been asked many, many times, why isn't Grant there? Why Grant should be there? And I said, well, Grant was not strong enough to be there. Whereas, and I want to show that contrast again between the minister and Grant. The minister is strong enough, brave enough to stand and walk with Jefferson. But although Grant had been there for a long time, he was not, didn't have the strength that on that particular, that last hour, that last minute. You know.
And yet it seemed as if Grant and everybody, at least everybody in the African American community, was there in terms of their awareness.
Oh yes, definitely. That's the opening sentence of the book. I was not there, yet I was there. Anyway, he's aware of all of everything that's happening.
And not just him, though. Everybody seemed to sense the moment.
Oh, yeah.
Right, that kind of supernatural portion of it, just that connectedness. Could you talk a little bit more about the minister? Because at first, the minister is not an appealing character. He seems to be a weaker character. And yet, when you look at his life, he's a strong man.
Yeah, well, I've had problem with ministers since I was a little bitty boy. So that's why I have a problem with this guy. Back in time of slavery, the masters of plantations used the minister to keep us, keep them in check. Forget all the problems you're going through today. There's a greater world for you up there. And a person and Grant's a person like Grant would resent that. I don't want to know about crossing yon river into heaven. I want to live on this side of the river today. And of course, the minister back in the 40s did not know, was not a Martin Luther King. He was not a civil rights leader. His job was to comfort the ill, to bury the dead, to baptize you, to visit you when you were ill. This is what's his duty. And Grant is saying, but I'm very strong, very well. I don't need all of that stuff. I need something else. So to Grant and to many others, the minister may seem weak, but he tells Grant, listen, I'm strong. I'm very well educated because I know what you must do for people. You teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, but you don't know anything about people.
Right.
And I know people. So in a way, he's a very, very strong person, although Grant can't see it. And as a young person, I could not see it either.
True.
But at the end, of course, he comes through.
What struck me was the passage where he helped Grant, who was irritated with his auntie and his godmother, to really appreciate what these women had done. And it seemed to me that a part of the minister's role was to help people who had no hope of a better life to be able to at least bear and have as much dignity as possible in this life. And that's something that Grant just didn't see, that he didn't see what his aunt had gone through for him.
Right, yeah.
So, and Alan, that just increased my respect for him, and that wasn't even a question on a card. So let me go to the next question from the audience, which is, are you currently working on a book?
Well, as Hemingway once said, it doesn't do to talk about it. I have started another novel. I've written about 7 chapters of it, but the juices are not coming up as much and strongly as done in past. So, yes, there is another book in the making, but when will it be completed? I have no idea.
So you can invite the muse, but you can't summon, command the muse.
Well, you know, there's an old saying by an old preacher, is that God may not come when you call him, but he's always on time. So the muse will be on time. When it's time, the muse will come along.
Okay, and this person also wants to know, how long did it take you to write A Lesson Before Dying?
I wrote A Lesson Before Dying over a period of 7 years, but I was writing only half of the year because I teach one semester. And when I'm teaching, I don't try to write. When I'm writing, I can't teach because teaching takes up a lot of all my time, although it's only one class, but it takes up a lot of my time. And writing is a very jealous mistress. She will not share with anybody. You give her all your time, or you will not bring anything. You will not produce anything.
How important do you think libraries are in today's electronic environment?
Well, I don't know what's going to happen in the future, but I think there'll always be a library. Maybe we may not have books, but the library will, there'll always be a place for, I should hope, there's always a place to go to. And not all of us get our little computer and lock up ourselves in our little rooms and not go around others. I don't know about what will happen to books. I don't know if they will all be on this disc and all that sort of thing, and you listen but not read. I don't know what's going to happen.
Nah, you can't curl up with even an e-book, I think. Okay, you've explained how much reading inspired you. Which authors do you enjoy reading today?
Oh, I still read many of the older authors that I had to read when I was a kid, when I was in college. I'll read a book. My wife, Diane, usually reads the book first. And if she says that, hey, this is pretty good, I'll read it. So whatever book she likes, and they're just sitting back there. Lana, honey, why don't you just stand up so they can see what my wife looks like over there. My wife, Diane.
Yay.
So I let her get to read the book first, and then she'll recommend it, and I'll go to read. We're always reading something.
Okay. Well, yeah, your wife said that, you know, I was asking her if she was a writer, and she said she's a lawyer, but she's an avid reader. And I thought, how wonderful for an author to have a lawyer that they could trust. But then you told me that you were fortunate to have agents that you can trust. So young writers out there, aspiring writers, keep in mind you want to trust your agent, or until you find the best agent, you want to get a lawyer on your side. Especially one who can also be an editor for the books
that
you read.
Well, she does a lot of my agency work as well as the promotional agency work as well.
How did you feel about having your works translated into films? Did you think, were you nervous about it? Were you right there on the set?
Oh, no, I always, whenever a producer or the agent asks for my book, I tell my agent to get as much money as we can. I tell him, I set a certain amount of what I think is a fair price for the right to make a film of my books. And I leave it up to the agent to argue with them until we get that. If they don't, we'll give it to us, leave them, you know, forget it. I think some of the films, we've had four films based on my work, beginning with the autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman, The Sky is Gray, which is a short story, A Gathering of Old Men, and A Lesson Before Dying. I think they did a very good job with A Lesson Before Dying. The person who wrote the script was a white woman from South Africa, and she had read the book very, very well, and she had read other books by me, my other books, articles, books about me. And so she had a thorough background as to who I was and my world. And having coming from South Africa, she could see these worlds so much alike. especially the South and the 40s here in this country. Yes. How it was with, compared to the, you know, the life that she knew in South Africa.
It's interesting. Mark Madhavani, who wrote The Boy, Kaffir Boy, that came out in the 80s and told so much about the realities of apartheid, lives in Portland now and has, you know, many of us have had a chance to listen to him. And as I think about his books and listen to the things that he said, they're just such similarities. You know, he's, I don't know, born in 1960 in South Africa, but the similarities are absolutely there. I didn't even realize until I finished reading the book and started listening to a gathering of old men that quarters, it didn't sink on a conscious level that quarters was short for slave quarters.
Right,
So in essence, people were still living and working in the exact same environment.
Oh, yeah, right.
Slaves
lived. When I grew up there, I was born in 1933, but during that time, there were people working this just as they'd done in slavery. Everything was done with hand. You chopped the sugar cane with a machete. You picked the cotton with your hand. You loaded everything was loaded by arm strength. The same just as we had been, 100 years before.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, this person says, your writing style and lesson tended to feed us information just when it was needed, but not a moment before. Is this intentional?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Okay, let's see. Your writing style and lesson tended to feed us information just when it was needed and not a moment before. Is this intentional?
Let me look at this.
Okay. Kind of suspense.
Your writing style and lesson.
Who was the person who raised that question?
My question is, when you wrote the book,
right?
Just when we'd be craving some piece of information, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it would be there, mm-hmm. but not a moment before.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
Is this an intentional writing style? Because there are times where you're craving it a chapter beforehand.
Mm-hmm. No, I wanted to write about the moment was happening, as though you were experiencing this at the moment that I was experiencing this, or the moment that the characters were experiencing these things. So I was not writing any introduction to what could happen, but you just live from one moment to another. Yes. Well, that was intended. Yes.
Your book was very touching and made a lot of people cry. Did you shed any tears?
Maybe when the first draft, you shed tears, but it was not because of the situation, but the writing was so poorly, and I didn't know how I was going to correct this stuff, so I did a lot of crying about that. But I shed tears now when I see the film, and when I see the play and the characters on stage and things like this. But when I was there writing, creating these characters, I was pretty cool about it. But now when I see them they're performing on a stage, it'll bring a tear every so often.
Okay, and this is a similar question. What was the most difficult scene in the book for you to write?
There were quite a few of them, but for example, I wrote, I think, the first two chapters or three chapters, maybe four chapters, and then I did leave the writing and go back to Louisiana to teach. And I left the writing just at the time when Grant would go back to visit Jefferson alone. I had no idea, and I was away from the writing for about 6 months while I was teaching in Louisiana. I did all my writing in San Francisco. I still do. Everything I've ever written, every thing I've ever had published was written in San Francisco.
Why?
That's where I lived.
And because you, when you were in other places, you were teaching and you don't overlap.
Right,
I thought maybe the Bay.
No. No, I stare at the wall when I'm writing. I don't know the wall. So I had no idea what he would say to Jefferson when he walked into that jail. Just blank. What will he say? And I had 6 months to think about it, wonder about it, worry about this stuff. And when he goes to this jail, Jefferson doesn't want to talk. And I said, I got to create something for at least 10 pages. He can't walk out the jail now. He's here now. And he has to do something within this hour. I think they'd give him an hour to talk. I said, he must do something within this hour. So that was difficult. Another difficult chapter was the chapter when he's standing at a bar just before seeing Vivian. Vivian, he has a whole hour on his hand before he will meet his girl. And he's having a drink. And I'm saying, okay, what's he going to do during that hour? I just don't want to say that he stood at the bar and drank for an hour. I didn't want that sort of thing. So this is 48. The story takes place in 48. Jackie Robinson had just broken in baseball in 47. So what I did, I got these old men at this bar talking about Jackie Robinson. And the old guys, arthritic, more arthritic than I am now. And they were showing how Jackie ran and how he threw the ball and how he slid in the base. So I had fun doing it once I thought about something to write about. At the same time, I was writing about James Joyce's Ivy Day in the Committee Room, that short story. And Grant putting all this together, the Ivy Day in the Committee Room short story by James Joyce, as well as with his old men. But when I went there to that bar, I had no idea. I knew Grant was going to get a drink, but what would he do afterwards? What would he do? And so that was, I had to come up with some kind of ideas. And that was a difficult chapter to write.
Here's another one. Regarding the fight in the Rainbow Grill, Grant Williams is under pressure from all sides throughout the story. He acts out violently towards other men once in the bar. How was the scene necessary to him and to the story, the big fight scene?
Well, I think the person explained it. He's frustrated with everything around him. And he would hear these guys talking and to relieve that frustration, get involved with that fight.
Okay. There's a lot of call and response and rhythm in your writing.
Oh, yes.
And I know that music is very important to you. Mm-hmm. Are you listening to music? Are you deliberately trying to have that rhythm, or is that just a part of the culture that you're writing about?
I love music. I listen to music all day. My wife and I keep the classical station on all day. We would even have our dog, Dee Dee, loving classical music. She loves classical music, She doesn't want to sleep at night without music, So we leave a light on, and she's in her crate, and we turn the radio down very softly. It plays classical music all night, so she goes to sleep like that. But we have a lot of music there. I'm a collector of music. I have hundreds of LPs and jazz, gospel music, rural as well as urban blues. So I'm very familiar with these, and we talk that way. We're constantly repeating things,
yes.
And especially in a place like Louisiana. We never say it was very hot that day. And we would say it was hot that day. This is really bad or something. We're constantly giving that call and response.
Okay, I'm getting a signal I'd like to ignore, but I guess I can't, that we need to start wrapping it up. But there is one question that I do have to ask, the last one from the high school class. This is from LaQuisha, and she says, in your book, there's a character who teaches inside a church, but doesn't attend church. Do you go to church? Quisha wants to know.
Not too often.
Okay, LaQuisha, that's
I know my wife goes to the church all the time, and she's always getting on me to, you know, I should go to church, but I don't go too often now.
Okay, I can't do one more, so another time we'll have to get the answer to the question, what is the most fun about being an author? So I'm just going to say I want to thank you very much, Mr. Gaines, for sharing your insights with us today. I want to thank you all for listening and for participating in Everybody Reads. I want to encourage everyone to join Mr. Gaines again this evening for the lecture at the Arlene Schnitzer at 7:30. Tickets still available. And if you would like to tell us what you think about this program and enter a drawing for $100 worth of Fred Meyer gift certificates, you can fill out an evaluation on the Everybody Reads website, which is www.multcolib.org/reads, www.multcolib.org/reads. And if you still didn't get it, just come into or call your local branch. This is Patricia Welch for KBOO Radio saying thank you very much for joining us today.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
And if you ever want to take this
out, I'm not getting what you're saying, Lee.
Okay,
well,
no, this is good. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, how are you? Get me. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. It's okay. You okay? Testing 1, 2, 3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
Testing, check, check, check. Testing, testing.
I'm Dallas Schaefer, and I read, read it in there that you talked about going into a library for the first time in San
check,
Francisco.
Check, check, check.
In Vallejo.
In Vallejo. I was curious, because I was a California person, and I was just wondering what library.
Well, there's the public library in Vallejo in 1949.
Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing.
Andrew right Carnegie right. Library. In,
yes. Right. Good.
Right. Okay.
Telling somebody about your video and how touching it was and everything. I hope you can use it for whatever your fundraising needs are.
I don't know if anybody told you about this. I know you visited the jails, but we have this huge juvenile justice program. And as a part of it, there's a program where parents who are in jail learn to do story times to read to their children. I mean, not just read the book, you know, but how to read it and show them the pictures and everything. And then when the child comes from a visit, the parent reads to them, a Polaroid is taken, so the child has a picture to take with them as a memory of it. And of course, they get the book. But in addition to that, after the child leaves, a videotape is taken of the parent reading to the child. And we saw three of them, and I mean, they were just so touching. They said with one man, I knew his voice seemed a little wavering, and they said that he just broke down the first time, so they had to do it over. There was another woman who was white, but clearly her child was biracial. So she was showing this book with a lot of multiracial characters. And she would say, and I mean, mind the child's not there, but she's saying, well, sweetie, can you look at this and see? She looks like you. She has your beautiful skin, your brown skin, your beautiful curly hair. And
then hi, everybody.
This character looks like,
you can know, you hear me all right?
Blah, blah, blah. And her skin is white. And I thought,
okay. It sounds very soft. Oh, there we go. Booming. Most of you know me. I'm Mary Lofton. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs. Thank you for coming today. There will be more people trickling in as they punch the clock and arrive for their lunch hour. But we wanted to kind of set the parameters and talk a little bit about what's happening today. So welcome to this special Everybody Reads event. It is organized by Multnomah County Library and the Library Foundation. Everybody Reads has involved thousands of friends and neighbors since the beginning of January, and we've all been reading and discussing the one great book, Mr. Ernest J. Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying. This classical book was chosen because it brings people of all ages together on common ground. As you know, Fred Meyer is the corporate leader in our state because of the support we provide to worthy community projects throughout our region. We are pleased to be the presenting sponsor of Everybody Reads and to have played a critical role in making it a huge success that it has been in the Portland area. Today's event will be an interview with the author of A Lesson Before Dying, Mr. Ernest J. Gaines, moderated by librarian Patricia Welch of the North Portland Branch Library. This is our opportunity to hear about Ernest J. Gaines' life as a writer and to ask questions about this year's Everybody Reads book, again, A Lesson Before Dying. One of the exciting things about today's event is that it's going to be broadcast live on KBOO Radio. This is the first ever live radio broadcast here at the Fred Meyer headquarters. I hope you enjoy being part of the studio audience for this interview. If you have questions of Mr. Gaines, please write them on the cards that are on your chairs and on tables. We've also provided some pencils at the tables. From these cards, you will have an opportunity at approximately 12:30 to ask these questions of Mr. Gaines. And in a few minutes, we will be turning the mic over to Patricia. We will go live at the strike of 12 and be live for the next hour. Thanks for being here.
We're having this conversation. And is this on? Yeah, it's on. Okay, so I should look up there, and at 12 o'clock, he's going to give me a cue. Actually, this is going to be easy, because all I have to do is ask you a question. It's on you, and you've done this a thousand times.
Well, not the questions.
Well, I tried not to come up with any trick questions.
Okay.
It's the kids.
Well, that's what I usually tell people about my characters. If a character say anything in the book, I said, it's not me. The character said it, not me. So that's how I get out of that.
Yeah. Have you ever started down one path and changed completely because, really, it just the characters just wouldn't
work? Of course. Miss Jane Pittman gave me more trouble than anyone else. The autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman.
Really?
That old lady just did what she wanted to do. I was just there. She went to her own direction.
One book took you 7 years. What's the book?
That was in my father's house. Took me 7 years. The book that took me less was Of Love and Dust, which was about 7 months, 7-8 months. Well, it's just a story that moved fast. I have a good narrative, good plot going, so everything moved.
Okay, how do you write? Your word processor?
I write longhand first, and then everything is written longhand. Mm-hmm. And then I go back to the word processor, to the computer after that.
Okay. I know what I wanted to ask you earlier. Okay, yeah, you're protected now because you have not one, but two agents. But before you had an agent, when you were trying to get an agent, when you were just out here.
No, I had an agent from the time I was in college. An agent discovered me. I published one little story in a literary magazine on campus, and